You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening, everybody. It's wonderful to be back here. Hello and welcome to Aloud. My name is Jessica Strand. I'm the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Through fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programs, the Library Foundation strengthens and promotes greater awareness of the Los Angeles Public Library and its essential services. This evening, I'm excited to introduce and to interview the compelling, thoughtful writer, conservationist and educator, and activist, Terry Tempest Williams. She's received both a Lannan Prize for her nonfiction and a Guggenheim Fellowship. Terry's written numerous books, including The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks, Refuge, and A Natural History of Family and Place, When Women Were Birds, the list goes on. Tonight, we're here to discuss a book that came out late 2019, a book titled Erosion, Essays of Undoing. Terry and I were scheduled to talk in March of 2020, but COVID-19 hit the week before and our program was canceled until further notice. At that time, we all retreated to our homes as the world shut down around us. We've spent the last year reflecting on ourselves, our families, our world, our losses. And during this time of fear and unrest, our administration changed too. Much of what Terry covered in her essays is as relevant and timely as it was before. But the world, the country, all of us have shifted quickly over the past year. We've changed. So tonight we'll talk about the shift, about change, erosion, and renewal. Please welcome Terry Tempest Williams. Hey, how are you, Terry?
Jessica, this is so, I hardly have the words. It's so powerful to see you, to be with you. I feel like you've been one of my companions during the pandemic. It began with a conversation with you, and I'm hoping that it's ending, at least that we're entering a new era with this conversation together. So I'm so grateful to you. I'm so grateful to the Los Angeles Library, to the Library Foundation, to Miranda. And I want to pay a particular tribute to my friend, Ken Brecker. I've known Ken for decades. I was so thrilled when I heard that he was the director. He is such an imaginative, creative thinker. And I feel like tonight is a celebration of family. I love his wife, Rebecca, and their son, Pierce. As you know, I revered your father. He made Salt Lake City a safer place for me to be. And I'm so grateful for our relationship because it feels familial. And it has only become deeper in our capacity to wait for this conversation. So blessings to you from a sister state of Utah.
Thank you so much for being here. It has been a journey and there are many threads and connections you have, obviously to Ken and his family and to the library and to me and to Utah and my father. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I wanted to begin with what I thought was a really beautiful, your book is beautiful, but this short paragraph, because I think it sort of illustrates we're going to talk about our frailty as people and what's going on in both the book itself, but also what's going on afterwards. And so when I saw this in the Cutting Edge of Time, Erosion of Home essay, I wanted to just begin with this. The ledgers of history revealed in the layered face of the Grand Canyon, moving through the fracture lines of the finery furnace in Arches National Park, walking across the knifed edge ridge of Angel's Landing in Zion, watching light captured and held within the pastel pinnacles of Bryce Canyon in shades of pink, orange, and yellow. All these weathered places show us we are merely humans, soft, humble, and temporary. And, you know, as we've discussed, when we first began talking about speaking together, and looking and setting this up. And I was looking through your books, your book, Erosion. It was such a different time in many ways. You know, I wanted to sort of talk to you about the national parks, our administration, the democracy as it was then, activism. And now things have shifted, and yet much remains the same. And so I want to begin by just asking you, you know, where are you now in relation to when you wrote Erosion? And also, how are you feeling about the essays in hindsight? How their relevance, how you feel now about having written them?
Well, I certainly think we have been, and we still are, in a time of erosion.
Yes.
So I feel it's an ongoing conversation. And in many ways, I feel that this book speaks to this moment in many ways, in clearer ways than when I wrote it, which I think is often the case with the books that we write, the books that are born out of questions. And so I'm aware that in many instances, our writing is ahead of us and that we grow into our books, just as we grow, not only as writers and the books that we write, but we grow into the books that we read, so that each time we enter them from a different perspective because we have changed. So in many ways, I think that is a natural evolution. But I don't think any of us could have understood where we were heading. Mm-hmm. And I think it still may very well be the case. You know, we want to know when a beginning is. We want to know when an ending is. But I think endings are more difficult to detect. And I really think we're still in, you know, I think what we thought was a pause is now a place, and we're still in that place. But what I'm aware of, Jessica, is the way we saw the world in March of 2020, I don't think that's how we are seeing the world now. And we're being asked to return to normal. And from my point of view, you asked me where I am. Normal feels crazy. And I don't want to return to that place. I want to be able to hold the stillness that we have encountered in these 15 months. I want to be much more attuned to the natural world, that it is a daily practice, not a vacation, you know, not a momentary reflection, but I want that to be my life. And so I think right now I'm wondering, how am I going to integrate that? How am I going to find that discipline to live a more intentional life? And I think about, you know, the poet Robert Pinsky, and he says, motion can be a place too. That was the place I was living in prior to this pause that we now know as a place. I don't want to be in motion physically. I want to be more rooted.
I mean, do you, I sort of feel that we lived in a society or live in a society that's constantly in motion. And we all had to slow down. So it's interesting you say that, because one of my questions to you was about a kind of attention and a kind of attentiveness that I feel you really have. So it's interesting when you say rooted in place, or that it's not a vacation, because the way you write is very, I mean, you are looking at birds' wings, you're looking at owls, you're looking at the earth in ways, in a time where we are not, I feel that attentiveness has eroded too. I mean, this is part of, and because of COVID, we've been asked, as you're saying, to root ourselves in ways and have to observe, right? And so, do you feel this is a shift you see with other people that you're around, that people seem to be paying more attention to things, and that in your own activism, let's speak about, you know, the parks and the feelings you felt in these essays in Erosion, which were, you know, it was a raw book of essays that were filled with a lot of emotion, you know, and some of that has shifted and is shifting. Do you feel that these changes, even though things are eroding, as you say, evolving, do you feel hopeful now out of this? Is there hope where those essays felt, you know, in the book? I wouldn't say hope. It felt like it was a reckoning with what was happening. And now, you know, where are you emotionally in terms of that? Do you feel we're moving to a new place?
I see a lot of this falling apart.
Okay.
I feel, you know, we held ourselves together for this year and a half, almost. I mean, we survived. But I think now we think, okay, it's now we can breathe, literally, and everything that metaphor and fact has brought to us in this year and a half, whether it was George Floyd, I can't breathe, whether it's the fires in California and Utah, that we can't breathe, whether it's we can't breathe because of the grief we feel for the people that we have lost, not to mention 600,000 of our fellow citizens. So I think we're scared. How are we going to go back into our lives? Do we want to go back into those same lives that in very many ways don't exist anymore? You know, I think I'm seeing a lot of health crises among my friends. I'm seeing people falling, you know, losing their balance. I'm seeing a lot of those kinds of exterior things of what we have been holding. I'm seeing a lot of anger. I see it in myself, you know, that if we are not consciously embracing our own griefs on so many levels, then I think it does come out sideways. Gun violence is up. You know, I feel that consciousness is what is required. Conversation is what is required. And we're terrified to talk to one another, that we might say the wrong things, that we might offend, that we don't have a voice, that we have no right.
I agree. I mean, I wanted to talk to you about that because I feel there's an erosion in dialogue in our culture, you know, and there's you touch on that in certain ways in this book. It's not a direct, you know, pointing, but it's now it feels like it's become more obvious. Yeah, we're very scared. We don't discuss things. We fear conversation. We fear opinion. We fear honesty. We're also scared of listening. And where does that bring us when we're looking at talking about grief? Like, let's go back to talking about grief and collective grief. I mean, you talk about grief in the essay on your brother, and it's personal grief. In a way that I think is very difficult. I mean, there are books about grief in our culture, but it's not something that it's something that particular cultures embrace and do really beautifully and others don't. Your essay is really touches the points in a beautiful way. And I'm wondering, what is how do we deal with collective grief right now? What does it mean to us as a culture? What do you think is going to guide us through looking at these massive amounts of death? How is that going to affect us? How is that eroding us? And yet, where is the renewal in it too?
You know, these are big questions. I think first we have to acknowledge, what am I grieving? That it's
right.
Personal. You know, what am I grieving? And how can I embrace that? When my brother died from suicide, I'll never forget a phone call that I received from my father, who is in his late 80s. And he said, "Terry, we have to stare it down." And I was so stunned by that. But I think that's right. You know, how do we find the strength to not look away from all that is breaking our hearts? And for me, Jessica, you know, having lost my mother as well, and I'm so sorry for your loss, that is so recent, and two brothers, and you know, we all have lost people and we know what grief feels like, But I remember the day that I recognized that grief was love. And somehow that turned it upside down, that I could bear it because I can bear love. And what would be worse for me is if I felt nothing. And so it's a way that I know that I am not numb, because that's what scares me the most.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's what, when you talk, when you use these phrases of, you know, erosion, I have them here, the renewal, it's you say the kind of continual process of there's erosion and renewal. I would think that the word love connected with grief has to do with processing it. It becomes, it's renewed within yourself because the person or the process, you understand it and you're able to love, which feels like a renewal rather than it eroding in you. You know, I guess I'm interested in the word erosion and how you use it in this book and how you were able to use it to really encompass so much. And so I'm going all over the place, but it encompasses so much of what we're going through at the moment right now. And yet there is a sense of renewal too. And I think it's an important word to look at and how it applies to where we are now and what we've been through.
You know, I hear you bringing up the word renewal and hope. And I would say, first of all, I find erosion beautiful because of the landscape where I live. Erosion to me is synonymous with essence. It's in the physical sense, in the geologic sense, you know, you see the sandstone being eroded away through wind, water, and time. And you're left with the essence, and it continues to change. And I think that's not only a truth, a geologic fact, but it's also a beautiful metaphor for us. And some geologists were in at our home not too long ago, Dr. Jeff Moore, and I think you will appreciate this. They have been thinking about the idea of resonance. That's a geologic term. What is the essence of stone and what is its plasticity? What is its structure? How stable is it, especially in a landscape that is predicated on erosion and instability, uncertainty? They put a seismometer at the base of Castleton Tower. It's a 400-foot wingate monolith. And then with the help of climbers, they put another seismometer at the top. They put on the earphones. And what they heard, Jessica, surprised them. It was a pulse, a heartbeat, almost like a fetal monitor. And what does that surprise us? That even stone has a pulse, a resonance. And they were able to hear in Castle Valley, Utah, the wave action of the Pacific Ocean where you are. They were able to hear the gurgling of the magma inside the earth and the immediate disturbance of a helicopter, even of human speech. I remember taking this extraordinary revelation to me down to Bears Ears, to Monument Valley, to a friend of mine, Jonah Yellowman, who is the spiritual advisor of the Bears Ears Coalition. And I said, Jonah, you've got to hear this pulse. This is stone. This is Castleton Tower. And he put it up to his ear. And he said, yes. Yes. You know, it's what Native people have always known, that science is now corroborating.
Which, you know, I have to say has really been a guiding force for me through COVID. The fact that I learned that, you know, trees communicate and, you know, the breadth of like the way whales communicate, and that we, you know, the sort of arrogance of the human being feeling that the rest of the world doesn't really communicate, but there are so many languages, and that underneath us there's life, and that, you know, moss comes back after 40 years, and that we can pick a rock up and hear a harp. I mean, these are things that keep us close to the earth. And I think cultures that are close to the earth and have not lost touch with that, you know, sense that all the time. And it's what you're talking about, I think, back to the beginning, about a kind of grounding.
And that we're not separate.
You know? No, one and the same. Right. And that what we think is human actually is much larger than that. It's a much bigger thing than just human. It has to do with being so interconnected to our environment and to everything, really, in ways that we didn't know. And I think that interconnectedness and that sense of community that you talk about in Erosion, and it is very important for us to lift ourselves out of where we are right now and to sort of understand and look at each other and realize the connectiveness, not just of ourselves, but how we are connected to everything around us.
And I was thinking about the poet John Freeman in his wonderful book, The Book of the Undoing, or Dictionary of the Undoing. And, you know, hope isn't a word I use a lot. I have to be honest with you, Jessica. But he brought me back into what he calls the field force of hope. His definition, as I understand it, of hope is that it is a field force. So this interconnectedness that you're talking about, this pulse of stone that I mentioned, that is a force field. Our desire to tell a story to one another is a force field. That is hope. That is renewal. And I think, as difficult as it is for us in this country now to listen to one another, to really have meaningful dialogue with the capacity to change, I think that is a force field that we have to embrace in order to reignite hope, that there is not so much as a uniting as a collaborating, you know, that what you bring to the conversation, what I bring to the conversation, is that creative third. You know, I feel it with my uncle. We could not be on more opposite ends of the spectrum. He is right of right, I may be left of left. But when we talk about the land, that is that meeting place for us. And that's where we begin. And I think,
because I heard you tell a story about your uncle, and I found it really interesting. I mean, I wonder if you would share it. I mean, because it was about erosion, right? He said that, did he try to read the book and he felt it was too angry or too, he asked you if you would write about beauty, that he could write, if you would write about beauty, then he could read the book. Which was interesting because your book is full of so much beauty. So to sort of tweeze out what that meant from two different opinions, I guess.
I tried to call him after the election because I wanted to know what he was thinking. And he wouldn't talk to me and he wouldn't call back. And then finally he did. And he said, you know, my family's very direct, as I imagine yours is too. And he just said, I don't want to talk to you. And I especially don't want to talk to you about politics. And I said, but Rich, if we aren't talking, then where is that bridge? And he said, there is no bridge. And that's why you're on one side of the moat, I'm on the other. Let's just stay there. And then we went through this litany. He said, are you going to change your opinion on abortion? No. Climate change? No. Same-sex marriage? No. Am I going to change myself? He said, on gun control? No. On the border? Immigration? No. So where are we? And I said, where are we is what we share, a love of nature. And he said, Terry, I read Erosion. It did not move me. It enraged me because of the politics. And he said, I've known you since you were born. I remember even as a child when you were on that beach at Laguna Beach, Capistrano, even then you had to touch everything. You had this feeling for nature. And he said, as you got older, you were always the last one to get into the station wagon. And he said, I don't even want to know what hocus pocus you were doing by the water's edge. But he said, you had a gift. Can you go back to that gift? And I said, what are you talking about, Rich? And he said, about beauty, about nature. Can you go back and write about that? And then I can hear you. And that rang true to me, Jessica. You know, and I had to ask myself, has my rhetoric become as brittle as my perception of my uncles and of the people that he supports politically? And I said to Rich, I will try. And then I said, and what will you do? And he said, I will keep the conversation going. Now, some of my friends were really offended by that, saying, you owe him nothing. What, you're going to change your writing at the time that when it's the most, we're at the most crucial place in terms of climate collapse, and you're going to stop writing about that and only about beauty, only keyword there. And all he does is say, I will keep talking to you. You know, you're capitulating to the patriarchy. I don't see it that way. I understand what they're saying, but I'm going to try it. I want to see in this next book, if there is one, what would it be, and is it possible to write only about beauty? What, where does that take us? And is that a bridge? And you know, you and I were talking the other day, the first time I had been on a plane for a year and a half, I went back to New York for a memorial of my editor, Dan Frank, of 24 years. And I stayed an extra day. You could tell the city had been through something. When I talked to people on the street, everyone wanted to talk. Everyone had a story. And I stayed an extra day and I went into the Museum of Modern Art. I cried my way through because of the beauty. Because I thought these enduring pieces, whether it was Van Gogh's Starry, Starry Night, whether it was Monet's Water Lilies, whether it was Frida Kahlo's Self-Portrait, whether it was Pollock's Explosion of Color and Motion, or Rothko, which the horizon line of red looked like the burning of the mountains where I live. I thought these pieces of beauty were born out of the vitality of the struggle. That's where
it's true of so much art. I mean, it's true of so much, but I think during this time where we've been kept from museums, I mean, you know, we haven't been able to go, we haven't been able to go to theater, we haven't been able to hear music live. And that kind of beauty and how we're moved, even if your uncle, even if it is a statement about something in our culture, you know what I mean? But the beauty of it, I mean, you know, for example, like the Alice Neal show, as painful as that is to see, it's about human suffering and human endurement and human connection. And we're faced with that in the art around us. And I think, you know, to be able to have that again in our culture, I mean, we're talking about how we crave it so much because of it being taken from us and not being able, and how that gives us a sense of the world. I mean, we look at nature for that. And I think we all took more walks and all those things and probably observed more. But we look for that reflection, that other part of when somebody's able to interpret it for us, because it's the interpretation of beauty you're talking about through looking at someone's view of it, right? I mean, let's talk about the desert a little bit. Let's talk about the paradox of the West for you. I like when you talk about that, when you talk about Utah and the paradox of it, you know, the Salt Lake, the desert, the mountains. I mean, it's your state. I'd like to talk about it a little bit. I want to talk about the paradox because it's in your writing so much and the way you're able to capture it for me in language gives it a kind of resonance and it gives me a way of looking at it. I know it does for many people. Very differently. So can you talk about the paradox of the West? Is that what attracts you? Or is it the beauty that attracts you first to writing about it, I guess?
I first want to apologize to the audience. I know that the audio is causing some difficulties. And it's ironic because I've been in the desert where, you know, our internet connection is so shaky, and here I'm in a city, and I am so sorry that some of you are having a hard time hearing the paradox. To me, beauty is the sibling of terror. Rilke showed us that. So, you know, beauty and terror are soulmates. In the desert, there's no place to hide. And so in a way, you're freed. You know, I've been aware, Jessica, of dear friends that have come to visit us during the pandemic, and they cry. They come to our house and they cry. And, you know, maybe it's because I'm a fright, or, you know, our cooking's bad, but I think it's because of the exposure. I think it's because of the raw beauty that invites them to be raw as well. I also think there's something, as in art or in deep communion that I feel with you when we speak, or in the landscape, whether it's the ocean, whether it's the desert, whether it's a forest, the land is able to absorb us. And talk about paradox, we become very, very small, and we become very, very large as we're absorbed into this stronger force field, if you will, the interconnectedness. So it's a paradox, but I think it's also a beautiful symmetry that we are revealed and we disappear at the same time.
I think it's a reckoning of our humanness somehow. I mean, it's, you know, back to sort of that beautiful passage that I read when we opened up, of merely being humans and soft and humble and temporary, is this sense of, you know, the existential moment when you are in Zion and you are an angel's landing and you're walking and it rains and you hear the thundering, you know, cavity around you, and you feel so small. And yet you're able to experience this. And I think, you know, what you're able to do in your essays, which is interesting to me, is you there's a meta, large, broad, and then you're able to go in with the kind of magnifying glass and look at the earth and look at the wings and look at things, the skeletal aspects of a creature in ways.
You know, I found this poem of your father's. I was rereading his work the other day, which I often do, because I feel like Mark got to the essence of things. You know, he didn't mess around. And I don't know how that strikes you, but I just loved the clarity and the bluntness.
And it was blunt. I think he was a kind of he was a poet who was very, there was enormous, I think it wasn't complicated. I think he tried to be very clear with image. And when he lived in Utah, which he did for years, as you know, I think it became a kind of a sort of nesting in which he was able to write very freely. And it's what you're saying about the desert. I think he was freed by the landscape and able to write very fluidly.
Tell me what you think about this. You know this poem, it's this story. It is the old story, complaints about the moon, sinking into the sea, about stars in the first light fading, about the lawn wet with dew, the lawn silver, the lawn cold. It goes on and on. A man stares at his shadow and says, it's the ash of himself falling away. Yes, say his days. And says his days are the real black holes in space, but none of it's true. You know the one I mean. It's the one about the minutes dying and the hours and the years. It's the story I tell about myself, about you, about everyone. You know, when I read this, I thought, this is erosion. This is the reckoning, the awakening and the reckoning at once. We are the moon. We are the wet lawn. It's my story. It's your story. it's death. And it is rebirth, the renewal that you're talking about. And, you know, I want to share a story, and I may have shared this with you, but I would love to share this with your listeners. Is I remember I was in the middle of refuge, and I had gone to a family reunion. And if you have forgotten who you are, go to a Mormon family reunion. Or if you want to forget who you are, go to a Mormon family reunion. And I came back, and my great aunt, a great aunt, B, said, "So Terry, what are you doing?" And she looked directly at my stomach, you know, and no, I wasn't pregnant. And I said, "Well, Aunt B, I'm writing a book." And she said, "Oh, are you? And what is that book about?" And I said, "It's about the rise of Great Salt Lake and the death of Mother." And she looked at me and she walked away. And the rest of the family reunion, I was in a trance. I went home and I thought, am I crazy? And I got out my childhood easel. And with one crayon, I put Mother, put a circle around it. Another one, I put Great Salt Lake, put a circle around it. I wrote everything that had to do with my mother, you know, family, Mormon church, et cetera, et cetera. Everything about Great Salt Lake, the birds, the bird refuge, et cetera, water. And there was nothing that connected them together. And as I stood back, I saw a map of the female reproductive system. And I thought, I can do that. But what ties it together? It was the narrator, me. I put TTW. And there were the ovaries, there was the uterus, and there was me. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I took the manuscript, and everything that had to do with my mother, I left in white. Everything that had to do with the lake and Great Salt Lake and birds, I put in another pile. And I could see that they were very uneven. There were more birds than family or my mother. And I realized in that moment, my goal was to integrate them. If it was too many birds, it was boring to many. If it was too much about cancer and my mother, it was too dark. So I took the pile about the birds. I put on my cowboy boots, put a belt around my nightgown, tore down Emigration Canyon to the Kinkos. It was 2:30 in the morning. I went into, you know, the shop. I handed the one very tired worker, you know, there, and I said, "Put this on the brightest paper you can, preferably turquoise." And she said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yes." And I sat there alone. The door opened. It was your father. It was Mark Strand.
Did you have a 2:30? We won't even ask. At Kinko's. So interesting. He must have been like trying to.
He was carrying a stack of poems.
Fantastic.
He looked as bad as I did, if Mark Strand can. And I looked at him and I thought, this is the most embarrassing moment of my life. I'm going to be handed a neon manuscript that looks like I'm publishing something for Hallmark cards. And it's Strand, you know? And I looked at Mark and I said, "Mark, good morning. Are there days where you wonder if you can go on one more minute?" And in that moment, Jessica, he could have slayed me. And he said, "Every single day." And the woman handed me the turquoise manuscript. Mark didn't even see that it was a different color. He was focused on his work at 2 a.m. And I always felt this incredible bond with your father, again, about that vitality of the struggle. And that in that moment, he held me with his humanity. I went back up the canyon. I went into the house. And in that moment, I took what I ended up calling the Strand Blue and shuffling it all together. And that's where I could see too much Great Salt Lake, too much grief. And I realized that my task was to create a light blue manuscript the color of Great Salt Lake.
Fascinating. Well, it's the integration of you, though, too, right? It's integrating all these parts of yourself, but it's in a manuscript. I mean, we do it sort of psychologically. We try to integrate all these aspects and parts of ourselves and make ourselves whole. And here is a manuscript in which you know, these experiences became a woman's reproductive system, humanity, women, all of it, you, yourself, you know, the death of your mother, the landscape that you look at. I mean, all of these things, it's really kind of an extraordinary story. I mean, where are you now? When you wrote Erosion and you talked about it, because I listened to interviews and stuff, and you said it was a kind of hell, you know? I guess, was it a hell writing the book, or the book itself was a kind of hell? And I'm wondering, what's next?
You know, it's funny, I don't remember saying that. I think anyone who's lost a loved one from suicide, it's as though you've been buried by an avalanche of questions that can never be answered. And I'm still buried under those questions. And it's coming on 3 years, and I think it's as acute as it, in many ways more acute, because I'm not in the shock of it. Even though my brother suffered from depression for decades. And in one conversation said, Terry, I have the rope. So, you know, these are the stories we live with. These are the people we love. And as you know, with the death of loved ones, the relationship continues. And it is a healing, which is a recognition, which is the embrace of grief, which is love, which is staring it down every day. And again, in the stillness, it's the stillness that we have felt during the pandemic of being home, being brought home to our knees. It's the stillness I experience in the desert. And in that stillness, there is no place to hide. And so we are found. And I think we're found in both the pain and the beauty of what it means to be human.
I would completely agree. I think grief, I mean, the interesting thing about grief, in that essay, I was so surprised that your brother said, you know, I'm eroding, Terry. You know, I mean, having witnessed death recently myself, that when someone says something of that nature to you, I know I'm dying, or I'm disappearing. And what's interesting about grief to me, and it's much of what you've said, but I feel like what happens is you grieve 3 years later because the person finds their way inside you and they live there. And they live there and you become their spokesperson there. They fill you and your body and the way you move in the world. And that keeps us remembering those we love. And that is part of love. And in a larger sense of what we've gone now through with a more, this sense of a kind of grief of how many people we've lost, you know, I think there is a way, as you're saying, it finds us. There are these silences in which we can't help but look at, you know, here, the homelessness, the boarded up stores, the what's happening to people and who we've lost. We can't help but think about those things. I'm wondering what you're writing now, what you're thinking about now, coming out of this, or being in it, finding our way out of it, or reckoning with so many things that now have surfaced. Are you going to write from a place of beauty now? Is that the next project? What's the next project for you?
I don't know. You know, I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about now is we have an opportunity to, you used the word at the beginning of our conversation tonight, shift, you know, to shift. And I want to talk to Mitt Romney. You know, he's my cousin and we've never met. And I want to ask him, you know, you have not been supportive of Utah's landscape, except for to drill and, in my mind, diminish it. And he has not been supportive of Bears Ears National Monument, And I want to say, dear cousin, you know, your father, my grandmother, came out of Mexico fleeing polygamy. And where they were given a one-way ticket to the landscape of their choice. And they came home to Utah. And he's been home now in Utah for a year and a half. And I want to know if his view of the landscape has changed. And I think, you know, we have an opportunity to say, I thought this way before the pandemic, but in this place that I thought was a pause that is now a place, I would like to acknowledge the change that has occurred in me. I feel differently. I want to do that myself. You know, I had this opinion before the pandemic. With this period of reflection and isolation and grief and beauty, I thought this before. Now I have moved into this place. So can we see this moment as a doorway through growth, through change? And does it give us cover to maybe lay down the burden of certainty to a place of eroding beauty? So that, like your father, when I said, Mark, are there moments where you think you can't go forward or you can't write another word? He could have said never. And I would have felt so lonely and lessened. Instead, he said every single day. And it was that embrace of the unknowing that allowed me to finish that book.
Oh, that's very beautiful. I mean,
we have an opportunity to be generous with each other. I guess that's what I'm saying. And to meet one another in our fears. To meet one another in our revelation, to meet one another as human beings rather than people of positions.
No, I mean, I think that I think we are at a point where we have to do that with each other in order to move forward. So I'm really glad you're saying that. I feel like there's so much fear around so much right now, and to be able to meet each other and just to be able to talk without fearing it is a beginning of some, even if there's an argument or confrontation of sorts, it can just be a dialogue that's heated. It doesn't have to end in violence or the rest. I mean, there is a way, and I think we've come to this place where we need to just settle, as you're saying, ground ourselves in what we'd like to talk about. And in that, there might be some dialogue that's not so heated that, you know, buildings are burned or people are, I don't know, that it's what you're saying. And I think that's really beautiful. I would, the idea of you talking to your cousin is amazing and looking at the land.
Tell me something, Jessica. What have you learned in this year and a half? Where are you?
I think I've learned that the world is a fragile place. I'm fragile. And yet we all endure in this kind of incredible way, and that we are interconnected to our world in a way that is awe-inspiring. And it makes me believe that we can bring ourselves to a better place if we just embrace our fragility and understand that we're all fragile, no matter who we are. I would love, before we go to Q&A, I'd love you to read from a burning testament a bit, so we can hear you reading. And it's applicable, so we can sort of bookend with two readings, one by me of your work and one by you reading your own work. And then we'll go to a few questions. Thank you,
Jeff. Thank you. I'm going to read just 3 minutes from, it's a book called A Burning Testament, that had its genesis in Los Angeles. Bianca Girever, who is a reporter for the New York Times, was doing a story on the fires of last September. She called me in the morning. She's in her 30s. I'm in my 60s. And she said, "Terry, this is so disorienting. I hardly know where I am. It choked with smoke. The sun looks like a burnt cigarette tip. And when I woke up this morning, all I could think of was an obituary for the land. Will you write one?" And the pre-pandemic me would have said, I don't know what that means. The pandemic me said, "I will try." And she said, "And I need it in an hour." And this is what came forth. This is the first paragraph and then the ending. "With these ashes in hand that have fallen from near and far on the drought-cracked desert of Utah, I raise my fist to a smoke-choked sky to honor the holy creatures, human and wild, who have lost their lives and homes to the galloping flames like riderless horses burning through the west. We are witness to ghostly horizons lit with the scalding colors of red, orange, purple, black, the blowout of close to 5 million acres of land being ravaged by fires. With such velocity, it is melting our capacity to feel the full magnitude of what is happening. We are not okay. We are anxious. We are scared. There is no place to run. There is no place to hide. There is only our love and grief to hold us in the terror of all we are seeing, sensing, denying. We can't touch the source of our despair because we can't touch each other. And so we retreat inside when everything outside is screaming. We are sitting in rooms watching screens alone, waiting as if this pause as if this is a pause instead of a place, the place where we find ourselves now. We cannot breathe. This is our mantra in America now. We cannot breathe because of the smoke. We cannot breathe because of a virus that has entered our homes. We cannot breathe because of police brutality and too many black bodies and brown bodies dead on the street. We cannot breathe because we are holding our breath for the people and places we love. I was asked to write an obituary for the land, but I realize I'm writing an obituary for us, for the life we have lost and can never return to. And within this burning of Western lands, our innocence and denial is in flames. The obituary will be short. The time came and these humans died from the old ways of being. Good riddance. It was time. Their cause of death was the terminal disease of solipsism, whereby humans put themselves at the center of the universe. It was only about them. And in so doing, they had been dead to the world that is alive. To the power of these burning, illuminated Western lands that have shaped our character, inspired our souls, and restored our belief in what is beautiful and enduring, I will never write your obituary. Because even as you burn, you are throwing down seeds that will sprout and flower. Trees will grow and forests will rise again as living testaments to how one survives change.
Surviving change. It's perfect. Thank you, Terry. That's so beautiful. It really is. I'll have to absorb and think about that. It was beautiful. I'm going to go to a couple of questions, which I'm going to shift over. We've got two really interesting questions here. I'm going to read a question. I teach middle school to underserved students who reside in a stark urban environment. They will be turning to school in the fall. What thoughts do you have of their erosion? And what path of grace may embrace their sense of loss and bring them back into a new world of possibility?
What a great question, and thank you to the person who asked this question, and thank you for teaching. Thank you for being in the classroom. Thank you for holding this space with our students, because it has to be disorienting for them. they've missed each other so, and teachers. I think what I would do is what I'm going to do with sixth graders on our porch in about 2 weeks. And that's have them tell the stories. I'm going to sit in a circle with these sixth graders and have each of them pair up in twos and have them tell a story about an experience in the pandemic. And for example, Jessica, if you and I were in sixth grade, I would tell you a story about an experience I had in the pandemic, and then you would tell me a story that you're having in the pandemic. And then I would have them sit in some place and just think about the story that they told, and then have them tell that story back to the group in their companion's voice. My name is Jessica Strand. The story I want to share with you during this pandemic is, and have it be this exercise of deep listening, the responsibility to tell your story that you were given true, with respect, and to feel what it's like to have been in that person's place. You know, there's an organization called Narrative 4, and this story exchange that I have participated in with that group changed me, because you realize the story you tell me is as much my story as it is your story. And I think it helps to begin a dialogue that each of us holds the other person's piece of that story, to this larger story that holds us. I think that's what I...
Beautiful idea. I also think that stories help us to process things, and it helps to contain a feeling, right? It helps to contain. And so it's a relief telling our story too. So they'll be relieved. I mean, I think that's a beautiful thing. Here's another question. It begins with, I admire your ability to keep from being totally crushed by your uncle. I read your work and I feel so empowered thinking in the manner that I do. But when met with the attitudes of the other side, I feel so foolhardy. I understand you want to keep the conversation going, but I am saddened that you will step away from the way it has been your habit of writing, the way that you write so beautifully and importantly. This isn't really a question, but I hope you can comment.
I don't see it as either or. I think it is being skillful. You know, I'm not going to stop writing about climate collapse. I can tell you, as you all must feel in California and wherever you are listening from, you know, we just watched 10,000 acres burn. I can tell you it's 109 degrees. You know, in Nevada, a friend in Las Vegas, it's going to be 118 tomorrow. We know the temperatures in Portland, you know, 115, 130 in Death Valley. We are literally on the front lines of climate collapse. I am not going to stop writing about that. I'm not going to stop writing about the bear that I saw at a full gallop, a young bear running from the flames, without food, without water, without shelter. But what I'm going to try to do is to do it in a way that is beyond politics, that touches our heart, that makes us weep, that realizes, that asks the question, can we love the earth enough to change? Can we love each other enough to change? Can we love ourselves enough? So it's not about letting go of what I care about. It's about finding a larger, more spacious way to write about it. And I think at the heart of that is beauty. And beauty is the beginning of terror.
We're just going to do one more question and then we'll end this evening. I do want to say that there was a comment from the man who wrote the first question, which is delightful. And he says, thank you. I will gather my classes under the giant pepper tree. which is really lovely. Anyway, here's another question. What are your thoughts about the obsession with personal electronics and technology and how it separates us from nature? Do you see a growing opposition to technology in the defense of nature? I understand the need for technology such as this medium we are using now, but is the human race in danger of totally losing their connection with nature?
Thank you for your question. You know, I think it's something we all wrestle with. It's, again, the paradox. On one hand, without technology, we would not be having this conversation. I would not view you, Jessica, as a dear friend and sister, had we not had this capacity to find an intimate dialogue through technology. I've been teaching at the Harvard Divinity School in this year and a half. I've never had more intimate classes. And it is beyond my capacity of comprehension to realize I've never hugged any of them. I've never met them. I've never laid eyes on them. And yet I've never seen such beautiful, deep, vulnerable, strong work. How did that happen? Is that a force field? Is that an energy field? Are we learning how to shape shift? You know, I love how Kim Stanley Robinson said, if you want to know where we are going, read science fiction. I feel like our lives are science fiction right now. Does it compare with one-on-one, holding one another's hands, holding one another's bodies, looking at one another's eyes? No, it doesn't. Yesterday, I was just in one of the canyons barefoot because I wanted to feel the heat in my soles to see how long I could bear it. That has nothing to do with technology. So I think technology is a tool that can allow us to transcend it in the way that nature is a reflection of who we are and where we come from and where we will return.
Well, on that note, technology has brought you and I together this evening, so I'm grateful for it there. And I'm grateful that we had this time. I wish we could talk longer. I wanna thank the Library Foundation and I wanna thank Terry Tempest Williams. I wanna thank the library and all those involved in making this happen this evening. And thank you. And please join us again for another Aloud program. It's wonderful to see you and it's wonderful to be here with all of you tonight. Thank you. Thank you, Terry. Take care.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.